The tighter monetary policy conditions that many advanced countries have adopted the last couple of years. Post-pandemic, there was a big surge in inflation as countries had injected quite a bit of fiscal stimulus, quite a bit of monetary stimulus to get economies going. Supply chains were broken, and that led to a big inflationary push. And to combat that, there has been a big tightening of monetary conditions. And our countries being, having a lot less access, even under normal conditions, to capital markets internationally, and domestic markets still remaining weak, have faced funding squeeze. Now, on top of this are, of course, vulnerabilities that countries had because, debt levels were very high. Impact of the shocks that have hit our countries in recent years have also weakened the fundamentals of our economies. There is some recovery taking place in the region. Growth was 3.4% in 2023, expecting to go up to about 3.8% this year, and a bit further to around 4% next year. This recovery is good, but as we stress in the note, nowhere near the robust levels of growth we need to see in the region to address all of our development challenges.
We're seeing governments across the region look elsewhere for financing options to address the deficit that they face. What's the impact on the economies and amid the high cost of living brought on by global inflation?
It's a really difficult environment right now, so it hasn't been as easy to get funding. So one of the consequences of this has been that countries have had to live a lot more within their means. Institutions like mine, the World Bank, have of course stepped forward. Just to give you a small example, I think since 2020, the IMF has provided financing to the tune of $58 billion just to the sub-Saharan African countries. The World Bank has also been providing quite a bit of support as countries have not had access to markets in recent years. So conditions remain difficult, but I think they're beginning to ease because earlier in the year we saw three countries, Cote d'Ivoire, Benin and Kenya, able to return markets and do some liability management operations. So we're hopeful that this will continue as countries' economic conditions improve.
The regional outlook notes Niger and Senegal among the region's fastest growing economies due to the oil and gas that is supposed to come on stream. Niamey, as we know, is still under military rule following a July 2023 coup. And the US, for instance, has agreed to a request to pull out its troops. Senegal now has its youngest president after months of a political deadlock over the organization of elections. Are you concerned that the projected growth of 10.4% and 8.3% for these West African states could be jeopardized?
Senegal has once again shown that it is a boisterous, robust democracy. There was a peaceful transition of power to a new leader. And, the new leadership has come up with some sound ideas about how to move the economy forward. We met with the Minister of Finance recently during our spring meetings, had very good discussions. They are taking a bit of time to look at what kind of policies they want to put in place, what they need to put in place, and they're working on that, and that's really fantastic that they take their time, look at how they can improve economic prospects there. In Niger, of course, it's going through a very difficult political transition. They also face the huge security challenges with terrorist attacks, internal conflicts that have been ongoing for a while in neighboring countries and now, unfortunately, spilling over there. We are also looking to see how we can support the government in Niger, and we're hopeful that we can reach agreement on we have a program that we're supporting under the Resilience and Sustainability Trust to help them address the climatic shocks. So we're hopeful that we can move forward in supporting them also in the coming week.
Let's focus our attention on world events that have had negative impacts on the region's economies. First, we talked about a pandemic, climate events which have led to drought and near famine in the Horn of Africa, for example. The war in Ukraine, which serves as a food basket for some African countries like Egypt. The fund is advocating fiscal resilience to withstand such shocks. How is the fund positioning itself to assist low-income economies to strengthen fiscal buffers, and in what capacity can the international community offer support?
That's a great question. I think, the last 4 or 5 years, I mean, we underestimate kind of what brutal cocktail of shocks have really hit countries in the region. Eh? There was the pandemic itself, of course, and that's been followed by, you know, other shocks which really have been as big in terms of their economic effects on the region. The pandemic, thankfully, saved us from the health effects, although the economic consequences are big, but the subsequent shocks have only served to exacerbate conditions in the region. As you said, higher fuel prices for the countries that are fuel importers, food prices across the region, so major cost of living crisis. What we've done as a fund in this context has been to step forward like never before, as I mentioned earlier, you know, providing financing to the tune of $58 billion, much of it through our zero interest rate facility is really, you know, a big contribution that we've made to help countries support their populations, to you know, make sure that they can, you know, support their economies. So that's the first thing that we've done. We, of course, continue to remain engaged in policy advice, even in those countries that do not borrow from us, you know, extensively. And as and when new shocks have been emerging, we also have been trying to lean forward to support countries. So just to give you an example, there's a wrenching drought taking place in southern Africa right now, impacting Zimbabwe, Zambia, Malawi, Mozambique, even some countries further south. And we are doing you know, our utmost to make sure that we can provide support, for example, to Malawi and Zambia to help them deal with this shock. But the fundamental solution to many of the challenges that we see is putting in place reforms that are going to help make our economies more resilient. And of course, the exact type of policies depends from country to country. But the, you know, really, I think what we are going to have to adopt policies that will improve our fiscal resilience, our, you know, resilience to external shocks, and these include measures like further domestic revenue mobilization. Our countries have done a lot of good things in terms of investing in all the right areas, in health, in education, and infrastructure over the last 20 years. But what we've not done enough is capture the rate of return on this investment through our tax system. So that's one of the things we have to do. Second, we also have to look at how the resources the governments collect are being spent. Are they being spent in those areas which will generate the highest rates of return for our economies?
Abebe, when you talk about reforms, one of the things that come up at the local level is that these reforms lead to government saying that they have to widen the tax net, get more money from the people who are already been burdened with high cost of living. How do you ensure that such reforms do not go to add added on burden to the consumer?
Okay, so I think that's a great question. And, you know, I don't, by no means do I mean to paint a picture where these reforms, these trade-offs that have to be made, you know, are easy. They're not. They really are very difficult. But they're also what needed to move our economies further. So if you need to spend more, if you cannot borrow more because that's sustainability constraints, then the only thing you have left is more tax revenue mobilization to, you know, make this thing work and make economic conditions improve. As I said before, in many countries, what you've seen is that economic activity has continued to expand, but tax collections have not kept pace with the expansion of economic activities. Our countries have not done enough of a job in terms of taxing new sectors of the economy as well. So we do see scope in many countries, to expand the tax net, to capture more and more people that are not currently being captured in the tax net. So to the point that you raised earlier about burdening the same people again, I think there is a way to make taxes a lot more equitable, a lot more broader, rather than deepening and taxing the same people further.
But when the tax net is widened and the people still do not feel that the basic things that are required for everyday living is lacking, then, you know, there's discontent. How do you respond to the people who say, why widen the tax net when it can still be seen in the lives of the economies?
We've done the right thing in expanding electricity access in many cases. Again, it's not universal. But the companies that have expanded electricity access are still, you know, not collecting even, you know, enough to just sustain themselves, much less repay the investments that they've made.
Abebe Selassie, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.